Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this edition of Progressive Politics, Tennessee Style, coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia. This is PPTS, presented as a service to the progressive community by the Coffee Party USA Radio Network. PPTS highlights the activities, activists, and activism of the progressive movement. Join our host and special guests as we discuss the most interesting and important topics of the day. If you have a cause, an issue, a campaign, or candidacy that you're actively engaged with, please feel free to give us a call at 646-929-2495 and share with us your question or comment. Join the show's co-host and producer, Progressive Patty, in our lively chat. Go to the bottom of this episode page, sign into the chat room, and let us know what you are doing about it. All opinions are welcome. For the Coffee Party USA and Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, welcome to today's show. Please make welcome our host and friend, the Tennessee Progressive.
Well, howdy, neighbor. Come on in. Come on up on the porch and set a spell. We got some sweet tea and cookies out here on the porch. It's a nice day here. Coming to you live from left and slightly south of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia, where for the next 2 hours I will be the Tennessee Progressive. Coming to you live, 5x5, wall to wall and coast to coast. Welcome to the show. This is Sunday, April 13th, 2014, and the topic of today's show, money. There's a lot of things going on around the universe this week, and we're going to focus on things in America mostly today. There's a lot of things to talk about, and it's going to be a call-in show where I'd like to get your opinions on several things. There's a major activity going on that involves many Americans today, and that's Tax Day, 15th of April, coming up this Tuesday. What are you doing? Have you filed your taxes? Are you getting a refund? Have you got your accountants working on it? Have you taken it to down the street tax preparation agency? Are you finding it easier, the same, or more difficult to file your taxes this year than you did last year? We'd like to hear your stories about how your tax day's going. Are you going to the party? Now, for those of you that know what I'm talking about, you'll have an answer for that, yes or no. For those of you that don't know what I'm talking about, it'll be an interesting thing to learn. I haven't participated in several years because I'm on a Social Security disability, and so I don't pay taxes. I don't make enough to pay taxes. But back in the day, we used to have parties, tax parties, and we would go out to the post office where they would have people lined up in lanes to take your completed tax forms sealed and signed and ready to go to the federal government, and they would pick them up for you up to midnight on April the 15th or whatever the tax day was. And people would go out there and sit and tailgate and have a party and listen to radio and chat with each other. It was fun. Became a bit of an annual outing, actually. Waiting until the very last minute to file your taxes, or having to work on your taxes until the very last minute and then file an extension like many of us did. And it was a time when people got together in the middle of a relatively unpleasant task and made something good out of it. I'm just thinking of all the good times that I used to have out of the Denver General Mail facility. Huge place out the airport. Go out and take our chairs and a cooler and bring some sandwiches and some pop, because you can't drink on federal land. And of course, that was long before you couldn't smoke on federal land. But it was a community thing, actually. It got started in panic. You know, people were screaming to the post office. It started at the downtown Denver post office and kind of wound its way out to the general mail facility at the airport because it was so much larger. And we used to go out and we used to, you know, go through the process of getting our envelope stamped on the correct day. And then we'd just sit in the parking lot and watch the people come screaming down the street to the Denver post office or out to the airport. And, of course, there were many post offices around the Denver area, and some of them were local neighborhood post offices, but we noticed the trend for people to stand around and talk to each other at this particular time, and we decided one year that we were going to have a party, and everybody that we saw in our local post office, we encouraged to go out to the airport, to the general mail facility, to file their taxes or to post their taxes into the mail. And we'd meet them out there, and we'd just, you know, get together. And that's how it started. I was not the one to come up with the idea, but we certainly were among the first to take advantage of it. And it was a good time, actually. And then, of course, after midnight, you know, everything would break up and go down. And we'd be home or go home. And we'd feel like we had a little bit of a community spirit about us for a while, because it was something that everybody had to go through. Well, we didn't have to go through it alone, and we didn't have to go through it badly, you know. So we tried to turn an unpleasant thing into a pleasant thing, and it worked. I hope that's still going on. And I suggested, if you intend to file your taxes on the 15th, that you find the largest mail facility you can that's accepting and stamping your envelopes up to midnight, and go out, file your taxes, and sit there and drink a pop and watch the crazy. And if you're out and about, you know, sitting around your car on a couple of lounge chairs in front of your front bumper watching the line go by, believe me, people will collect. You can share your horror stories or your victory stories. And there's a little bit more that you do than simply file your taxes. You've got to understand that, you know, this is one of the things that people talk about a lot when they talk about politics. And that is, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? And why does it have to happen this way? We're taking our hard-earned money and we're giving it to the federal government. Why? What is that money buying us? Focus of today's show. What is our money buying us? So you'll want to write that down and put it on a piece of paper and keep it in front of you as the show goes on. Now, you can call us at area code 646, numbers 929-2495. And you can get on the air with me and tell me your story and your opinions, and all that sort of stuff. And let's have a chat about it.
What do you think your money should be buying you? And what do you think your money shouldn't buy? I believe that we can have a civil discourse on this. We're going to have some things to talk about regarding that. But tell you that today we will visit the subjects of Tax Day 2014. We will talk for a little bit about a little kerfuffle out in Nevada. And we'll talk about McCutcheon a little bit, the McCutcheon versus FEC decision. And we'll talk about the conservative movement, the Tea Party movement, and rebellion via open militia a little bit. So if you want to think about those subjects a little bit, give us a call, let us know. You can also join us in our chat room by going to the bottom of today's page, or today's show page, where you'll find our chat room, and Progressive Patty and the whole team is there. I'm there. I don't generally participate in chat, but we do answer your questions and comments on the air that you make in chat when we can. And this has been an interesting week dealing with money, the power of money, and who has the money, and who believes they're entitled to the money, and what it is that they think their money should be able to do. But this is a time of year when we all look to our federal government and say, okay, here it is, give me my money back, or here's the money I owe you. I've got a real funny notion about taxes and paying taxes. It comes from a citizen's perspective, not necessarily a political party's perspective. But there's room for conversation, and the coffee party is very much involved and dedicated to the proposition that we can meet and have civil discourse with civility, honor, and respect about issues with which we may disagree. Hopefully, if we can't come up with a better answer, maybe we can come up with a better question. We have two rules on the show. The first one is, play nice. Remember that you're a guest in someone else's house. And the second rule is, come prepared. If you have an opinion, put a big box around it and say that's your opinion, and we'll let you let it rip. And we'll, if we can, talk to you about that opinion. But it's really more important that you talk than we do. So feel free to give us a call at area code 646-929-2495. And let me know how you feel about this tax day. Taxes represent money, but they don't really. Your tax dollars go into the funds that generate, create, maintain, operate the federal government of the United States of America. Way back when, after the establishment of the Constitution, after America had somehow figured out a way to pay for a second Revolutionary War in 1812, we had learned that the Articles of Confederation did not do what they set out to do. They needed, for instance, for the states to pay for their militias or to pay taxes to the federal government so that the federal government could operate. And while it was a responsibility of the several states to do that, they didn't many times. And so there had to be a way to legitimately fund a federal government. Conversation went on throughout the conventions in Philadelphia and New York, and the Articles of Confederation were pretty much set aside because of the multi-sovereign issues that they involved, whether or not a state law should preempt a federal law, or the participation by the states in the federalized government should be strong or weak. And by the time of the election for the second president, after George Washington retired, there were factions established. And one was headed up by a Massachusetts man by the name of John Adams, and the second one was set up by a guy from the South, Virginia, northern neck of Virginia, by the name of Thomas Jefferson. And there was still a strong argument going on about federalism versus loyalism. And the first 10 amendments to the Constitution had been added. The reason for that was because the concerns that many states had regarding the Constitution itself had not really been answered. There was a feeling that first we must be independent before we can decide how we establish and maintain an independent country. So a lot of the issues that were niggling those people, like, you know, for instance, the state of Rhode Island or North Carolina, that decided they did not want to submit themselves to a supreme government, were addressed in the 10 amendments that became known much later as the Bill of Rights. And this helped establish and solidify the 13 original colonies into individual sovereign states with pretty much independent autonomy for the most part. And there were some things that all states agreed that they would be subject to under a federalized government to enjoy the benefits of that government within their states amongst their citizens. The conversation about where that line is or should be has been ongoing ever since. And it is an interesting history for those of us that like history, I guess. But there are 27 amendments in total to the Constitution. And the 17th Amendment of the United States Constitution did a couple of things. The first thing it did was that it changed how our upper house of government was composed. And it went from a legislative chaos to a standardized system within the Senate where each state would be allowed to elect two senators. It was not designed to be populist. It was designed to be functional. And the lower house, the people's house, was always intended to be larger than the upper house. And more than anything else, the design was changed to represent more accurately the purpose of the Senate. And, you know, we've gone through the establishment of the country, the articles which set forth the powers of the Congress and the President and the judiciary, and trying to maintain checks and balances in a democratic system that would set us apart from other systems, had really begun in earnest. And while the Constitution itself was pro-democracy and pro-populist, it was also pro-slavery and did not solve some issues that perhaps should have been solved before, but as it has generally been laid out by those who were there, while these issues were aware and apparent, The first requirement was that we be an independent nation. In the meantime, and don't, you know, believe that that was the only thing going on, because it wasn't. Every state was creating a constitution, and those constitutions were considered to be supreme law in the state, with the exception of the fact that the federal government had some things to say about it. And then with one of the first cases of the newly formed Supreme Court, the Supreme Court was given the final responsibility for reviewing constitutional issues when there came conflict between, say, state constitutions and federal constitutions, which even further realigned the situation between the several states and the federal government. And then on February 3rd, 1913, it was formalized through the 16th Amendment that the Congress was given the power by the people to collect or lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever sources derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. That is the 16th Amendment. And it was ratified on February the 3rd in the year 1913, which of course gave rise to among other things, the Department of Treasury, and continued the argument Mr. Hamilton had had for some time about a national bank and how to collect those taxes. And where there had been temporary or occasional taxes in the past, the idea was that we were going to eliminate a lot of taxes, that not necessarily by amount but by name, and combine them into a general tax that would be collected once a year instead of taxes that were collected at several state and federal dates throughout the year, depending on what your status was as an individual and as a person and as a business. And this is one of the things that most people agreed to, because they were being taxed constantly. And, you know, it was like every 4 weeks you were having to pay a different tax. So what they did was they unified it. At the time, it was thought to be a wonderful invention. And Congress was not going to have a Treasury office where, you know, you came to Washington and paid your taxes to the Congress. What they did was they established an agency within the United States federal government to do that, and would come to be known as the Internal Revenue Service. And the Internal Revenue Service was, as an agent of the Treasury, the collector of taxes, the official repository for the taxes collected until they were transferred into the general fund of the United States Treasury for the operation of the federal government. And the 16th Amendment began to address not only taxation itself, but the relationship between the federal government and the citizens of the United States versus state governments and the citizens of states, because one of the things the amendment did not do was it did not deny the states the right to collect their own taxes. So we actually created a two-tier system whereby you had a federal government tax and you had a state tax. And the states collected varying amounts of taxes in varying different ways and sent to various and sundry departments or individuals within the state. And that was a way to fund state government and allowing it to do things for its local citizens that it could not otherwise do. And we came down with several important, you know, departments that we thought really should be universally addressed. And those that every state agreed over time would establish federal departments that became cabinet-level positions. a lot of those things were not uniformly set up because states still had the autonomy to do with their taxes as they would. And, of course, you had various and sundry taxes upon various and sundry things at various and sundry times to deal with those things that the state was expected by its people to provide, or that the state could provide better than its people could. And the idea of localist populism became very popular when, you know, my taxes are paid at home. They need to be spent at home. So you had local ordinances for taxes, and you had local councils for those things that those taxes should be spent upon. And, you know, you had things like education and those sorts of things that would eventually become multiple presences at both state and the federal level, because there were things that the states could not provide that the federal government only could provide, but the federal government could only provide them if it was funded, from a standing army to education on a national basis to all kinds of things. You know, there's a big bailiwick of different concerns. And not every state had the same concerns, which is why the states were left to their own devices to manage their states as would best represent the people, the idea being the intrusion of the federal government into state situations became noticeable. And it became noticeable in the power of the federal government to collect taxes and import duties and charge fees and things like that for things in which it participated that may or may not have been agreed to by citizens of individual states. And things kept growing apart. And you had individuals who were figuring out ways to have their money useful to them. And they would pay these taxes, but they expected them back in terms of contracts and agreements and things like that. You know, it wasn't enough just to pay taxes so that the federal government could protect open lands. It was important that those taxes were paid on the lands that individuals preferred. And the federal government had a responsibility at a national level to create public lands that it generated over the course of its history from before its founding to even today. The question is, what should the money be used for? Now, that's an issue that gets people going on a regular basis, and we understand that. Is it right, is it fair that taxes be collected? Well, some say no, some say yes. The ones who say no tend to say that because they see the federal government as an entire body to be an intrusion to their rights. And I think there's a limited case to be made in favor of that view. However, the agreement was, in order to form a more perfect union, that citizens would give up some of their autonomy, some of their sovereignty, to the federal government so that they might be a part of a larger union to receive additional benefits and protections from foreign invaders or insurrection and rebellion and people who decided that they were going to take the law in their own hands in some states' cases and all that sort of stuff. But it was an economic pressure which really compelled the argument to go forward. And the disagreement between those of various and sundry sides led to an escalation of hostilities that would eventually break out in the Civil War. The war between the states. The war against Northern aggression. The recent unpleasantness, as some have called it, down this way. And we have to understand that it was in a very real sense an economic war, which is the point of today's discussion. And the economic power of the northeastern states could not be matched by the agricultural agrarian society of the South. However, the South had a particular advantage in the political structure that the Constitution had given it. And as a result, up until 1860, the presidents of the United States had some things in common. One was that without exception, they had either been secretaries of state, which dealt with national and international issues on the global stage, or they had been military generals within the United States military service. Another commonality was that, with two exceptions, they were Southern presidents. Washington, Jefferson. Now, there were some, the exceptions were both from Massachusetts, both in the same family. And John Adams and John Quincy Adams, Massachusetts men, which was at the time the largest populous state in the Union. And when Thomas Jefferson came on the scene, he had some different views as to what federalism was and how it should be established. And in his first attempt in 1796 to become the second president of the United States, he lost. And he lost because of one state. He lost because of one state that actually turned its attention and its dedication and its loyalty from one idea to the other in the middle of the election. And as a result of that, John Adams won. But in 1800, Jefferson had learned something that he maybe had not really understood or dealt with. And there was a hidden power in the electorate. Based upon representation that just hadn't been exercised before. But Jefferson exercised it in 1800 because of the three-fifths rule. The populace changed to the South being more populous than the North. And as a result of that, the Southern candidate won and would win thereon up until 1860. And that was kind of like the trade balance, because the Northeast had the power of manufacture and exportation and trade internationally, while the South was building quietly the cotton curtain and was generating goods to be finished in the North and sold across the water and used by members of American society out in the plains of, you know, Kentucky and all the lands that could be had northwest territory was all lands in America northwest of the state of Ohio River. And then the Southwest Territory that Mr. Jefferson got real happy about, that would become, among other things, the Louisiana Purchase. And the issue then became, well, do we expand this three-fifths rule to allow equalization between the power of manufacturing in a densely populated area and the agrarian areas that felt like they were not being fairly treated or represented, or they were being actively and very vociferously disrespected in American culture? So we have to understand that at this point, that conversation had been going on for some time, and it was still going on at the time of 1856 when things got a little crazy. There was a large number of issues dealing with the power of the federal government, centralized government, and its rights to dictate to states what states should be doing or should not be doing or how they should be doing it. And one of the arguments was by the citizens of the southern states that we pay our taxes just like everybody else. Of course, we're the white landowners and all of that, but we don't like paying our taxes. And if you're going to try to dictate to us how we generate our income, we're going to refuse to pay our taxes. And the government said, well, you really can't do that because you're not completely sovereign. South Carolina was once again holding forth its determination to be sovereign among sovereigns and felt itself to be necessarily above and beyond anything the federal land should do. And there was a lot of controversy. It involved things like nullification, and which says if this state believes that a constitutional law is unconstitutional, we're going to call it unconstitutional, and we're not going to abide by it. That involved, by the way, the first case involved the submission of federal taxes. So taxation, which of course had been a rallying cry, many would say positive propaganda, to help establish this nation, with, you know, among other things, the Tea Party and that whole. The Tea Party is nothing but a representation of a general of affairs at the time, where first we felt that taxation without representation was cause for rebellion. Now we feel that taxation with representation is cause for rebellion. And we grew up this notion that, you know, you could argue about the taxes that were owed because you felt like you had a right to determine how they were spent. And that wasn't the agreement. The agreement was that everybody would give a little bit of their treasure to a federal government that would provide for them things that they could not easily provide for themselves. While each state was guaranteed the right to stand a militia in time of invasion, we also had created a standing army, and interestingly enough, we also had established a standing navy. The difference being between the two that the navy was a forever proposition while the army had to be reestablished every 2 years. And that didn't work out too well because the threats were not quite so timely, you know. And it became a natural source to continuously reappropriate funds for the army. So while the army, in effect, had to stand down every 2 years, it didn't, because of the continuing concerns over security and safety and international. It was a very international time, a time of great international distress. And there was never any doubt that there were those who would love very much to take the lands and the subjugate the individual will of the people within the United States, from Spain to France to Britain and other sources. And the international concern was not only an extremely important part of our Constitution, but it was also important in the continuation of the nation, because now we were, you know, on a global stage in a sense, and we had a president and a Congress and a Senate and a House of Representatives. We had states and we had individual autonomy going on in those places. And it's terribly important to understand that people who were here who were not necessarily of the aristocratic class, because one of the things we did was we denied we absolutely denied the ability of an aristocracy in this country. And we said that we, the people, very democratic term, egalitarian term, we the people. And everything that our documents that were used in our founding dealt with had to do with we the people. It was a bottom-up scenario instead of it pressing down from the top as monarchy had done. We had determined that it wasn't necessarily the divine right of kings to operate anywhere, and they couldn't just come and say, well, we're going to go to war, so we're going to take your land unless you pay us tribute. We felt like there was a better way to do it, that everybody could give according to their ability and take according to their need. And that was an interesting concept that came to play as a minor role in the beginning in the idea of the Republic and of democratic society. You had to understand that it had to be democratic in order for success to be seen, because every man stood to lose his life in not only the War of Independence, but also in, you know, the Second Revolution in 1812. So some would say there was greater justification to send money to the federal government then than there is now. I would disagree with that, but it's okay. You know, we can talk about it. You can call us at 646-929-2495. And as long as you play nice and come prepared, we'll talk to you in our chat room. We'll talk to you on the radio. Why do you send taxes to the government? Is it a punishment for being a citizen? Is it some kind of punishment tax where you have to, you know, pay to play? Well, not necessarily, because there are a lot of people who play pretty well and don't pay a penny's tax. In fact, they get paid to pay. They get paid to play. Is that fair? We have carved out through the history of the United States with an enormous, enormous tax code based upon exemptions primarily to taxes that have to be paid by people who feel that their contributions are more worthy than others, or that their presence and the economic reality of life here should somehow exempt them, or even to the point where the federal government should support them in those efforts, because what they do is singularly significant to the purposes that are given to collect taxes in the first place. So, this whole notion of what taxation is, what taxes do, and how they should be used, has been an ongoing conversation for quite a while. We have seen it in various and sundry scenarios throughout our history, from, you know, the Stamp Act and delaying a collection of taxes without representation in our British Parliament. We could be taxed at the pleasure of the king, but we couldn't have representation in Parliament that were, you know, making these laws. And a lot of people felt that was unfair. So when we really corralled ourselves into a corner where our only option, if we intended to do anything, was the only option we had at that point, we had to determine whether or not we were actually going to do that, whether we were going to exist as an independent country, or whether we were going to subject ourselves to a continuing rule by King George III, who really didn't care much about us. Now, he did send troops to defend us, to keep us safe, so that we could provide those amazing resources that only we could provide, because there was no place else in the world to get them. And, you know, that represents when you lose a vast bulk of your national resource, that can be a big deal. Well, we came to realize that too. What first had become apparent to the British became apparent in a very short number of years to us. You know, it's great to have a manufacturing base in the northeastern United States, unless, of course, they have no raw products to use to finish to make their manufacturing goods. And the issues became taxation. It was economic pressure, which compelled both sides in what would become known as the American Civil War to state their case in offense to or defense of, among other things, the institution of slavery. And physical property, you know, you can't own a chair. It didn't make sense to a lot of people in the southern United States because that's what they felt they were being told. You do not have the right to own personal property. Well, who are you to tell me what personal property I can or cannot own? It was also a matter of a way of life. It was also a matter of industrial power. It was also a matter of doing for yourself what the government could or would not do for you. And this, if you owned this particular property and you managed it as cheaply as possible, you had better the right to create a positive income for yourself and also inheritable goods and lands and things like that, because among other things, you know, slaves were inherited. Mr. Jefferson was well known to say that he really truly believed that by the second generation, slavery would have been dealt with and outlawed and not only unnecessary, but universally unacceptable. Of course, you know, at the same time you had Missouri coming about as a territory, and there was a question about whether or not it was going to be a free state or a slave state. And that really opened up the western lands. And you got to remember that the western tip of Kentucky at one point was the furthest region of the United States. And that happened to be true until the Missouri kerfuffle started. And all of a sudden it became a big issue because there was a standing line that says you will not tell this territory how to become a state. And the Fed said, well, actually, yeah, we will. And of course, the question was, did the federal government have the right to do that, and did our taxes support such notions? Again, taxation became a question. So with that 45-minute primer, we got a couple of callers that I want to listen to for a couple of minutes. We've got our first caller is Joe from Montana. He says, hello, Joe. This is the show. Welcome.
Hey.
How you doing?
Okay. I want to find out what the coffee party was about, because in the chat room it says that you're progressive.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, well, you've already got the Democrats and the Republicans.
Yeah.
So if you're going to be a coffee party, we already have the Tea Party, but you're progressive. What makes mm-hmm. you different than anybody else?
I believe that one of the things that makes us different is that we tend to be progressive in our action. It's not necessarily a party as opposed to Democrats or Republicans. It's a collection of people who really want to move America forward, regardless of political stripe, to do what is best for the people of the United States and of the world. We're not tied to a particular conservative or liberal ideology, except that we believe that everyone has value and every voice has merit, and we hope to be a place where people of opposing views can come together through civil discourse and come to an agreement about what can be done. Not necessarily an all-or-nothing proposition, but that through, among other things, the power of civil discourse, the citizen of the United States can be re-entrenched in the responsibilities, obligations, and privileges of citizenship to affect the change they seek. And that's primarily what the coffee party is.
Okay. And my second question is, just before you picked up, you were talking about whether or not the federal government would have the right to tell a territory how to be a state.
Yeah.
Well, I would have to say yeah, because if somebody wants to join a club, you don't walk into the club and say, okay, I want you to do this and this and this and this and this for me. If you want to become a member of the club, you've got to join the club on its terms.
Well, I would understand that. I would also say that there have certainly been cases in clubs where people have said, you know, you really need me to be a member here. And in order for me to be a member here, you're going to have to give me a break that you might not give some of your other members, because, as you will soon see, I'm much more important to the success of your club than you seem to think.
Yeah, well, I've already done that. I've negotiated higher salaries based upon that principle. But the thing is, when they've had the Constitution in place, for the people who were in charge of the Constitution, the Congress, to give any particular territory a break, or as opposed to other territories becoming a state, that would have created an uproar, and that would have meant some secret dealings behind closed doors, and that wouldn't have been proper.
Well, that's what the Articles of Confederation taught us, that while they moved us toward what we would become, there was an awful lot of negotiation between governors of states and their senators that they elected to go and represent the best interests of their states to the federal government, to get as much from the federal government for the states as they could. In other words, a reverse flow of what we have today. That didn't work out too well, because when it came to what the states expected, that was one thing. But when it came to what the federal government needed, that was something else again. You know, they'd say, give us what we need, good luck with what you need, from the Revolution forward. And the reason, one of the primary reasons that the convention happened was purely because of this. And while it may seem to be counterintuitive, that was the reality on the ground. And the federal government, through the Articles of Confederation, simply could not do the work that it needed to do. And the federal executive certainly had very few powers. I mean, there wasn't a governor that wasn't more powerful than the executive of the nation under the Articles of Confederation. So when these new territories came about, it was a transition time, really, when you were looking at a difference between the power of one and the power of the other. And there were a lot of people who said, wait a minute, we're not going to have backdoor, backyard, backroom dealings in order to agree that we're going to then protect you and provide services to you and all that at your behest. That ain't the way this is going to happen. Well, they could say that, but they couldn't enforce it. So under the Constitution, they set out some rules about what federalization or federalism was, and then allowed the states to agree to those rules. But every state that joined the Union came to it from a different perspective and had things to offer. Some had land, some had industry, some had resource. And they said, how about some consideration for this? And the consideration eventually wound up being, well, that consideration is what leads us to think about allowing you to become a state. But in order to become a state, you have to give up just a little bit of your sovereignty to the federal government, because you become a federalized part of a union. The other thing they said was, once you join, you can't ever quit. So as corporations have their rules that says, you know, we can release you for cause without notice and without warning, or we cannot, depending on the corporation. A lot of the states had the same thing as they built their constitutions. And one of the things that was very, flexible in the creation of state constitutions was the relationship that they had with the federal government. And this was a major cause of uproars up and down from the north to the south Atlantic and as we extended west. So the question was, if I pay taxes to you, what do I get in return? Because in a very real sense, if I'm paying taxes to you, that's less tax I can collect for my own state. And the economic considerations of statehood were significant on both sides. And
so do you have examples of territories which have given up sovereignty or resources or given up something more than other states?
More than other states? No, but yeah. I think the list being universal may have a different effect on several states. If you're giving up paying into the kitty, if you will, to become a state in the United States, up and down the seaboard from Rhode Island and New Hampshire down to Georgia, there were certain things that were gained by statehood, like populist representation in the Congress, like the defense. You know, it doesn't take quite as much to defend Rhode Island as it does Massachusetts or New York. The size of the state, the resources of the state, the federal government more than anything else became a vendor in that, you know, all that wood that was being chopped down for all those ships in Massachusetts, when it wasn't being used to build ships, it would go to other causes, and it could be bought or transferred to the United States, which is where the whole concept of public lands came from. And one of the things that states did give up was a percentage of their physical makeup over time. This is not day one, but over time, to the idea of the creation of public lands that everybody could use. And that, of course, differed by the size of the state. Population differed by size of the state. Location of the metropolitan areas, the population density centers. Some states had more than others.
I'd like to know where those kind of documents would be in order to verify that.
Look at each state constitution.
In the Constitution?
No, I said look at each state constitution, because they're all different.
Okay.
Yeah, they're each different.
So, from my understanding, is that if a mm-hmm. state was to become part of a union, mm-hmm. I would have thought that, for example, Oklahoma would have wanted to become the state of Oklahoma in order to have the cavalry protect the citizens against the Indians. So, in order to become the member of the club, you have to conform to the rules, and the mm-hmm. rules were clearly stated in the Constitution. So, I don't know where, you know, it's possible other states would have had to have made some sort of negotiations with the with Congress in order to become a member of the Union, but...
Well, you have to remember that only 9 of the 13 states ratified the Constitution. 4 of the states refused.
Which was a, two-thirds, so that's okay.
No, it did turn out to be two-thirds, but there were still a third... There were still 4 states that did not choose to ratify and initially become
mm-hmm.
states. Now, that the reason that each of those states resisted was unique to each state. They had different concerns. There were different concerns between, for instance, Rhode Island and South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but the negotiations that went into the desire to have 13 states as members of this union, among other things, led to the first 10 amendments that were, you know, almost immediately in 1789 drawn up to answer the concerns that those 4 states had, and to unify concerns that had been equally distributed among each of the states that did ratify. And for instance, the rights of life, liberty, and property were uniformly inserted into 9 states' constitutions. So in order to solidify that as a national ideal, it was put in the Bill of Rights. But there were some things that were addressed or not addressed, more importantly, at the time between the ratification of the Constitution and the full ratification by the 13 states to that Constitution. There was a lot of negotiating.
The Bill of Rights wasn't part of the Constitution until 2 years later.
Right. And that's, you know, first we have to survive the Revolution as we identify that we are a nation. You know, we invented our own history in the Declaration. We made definition of who the people were, what a citizen was, just out of nothing. And then once that task was done, we then had the situation of dealing with those who had fought but had not chosen to ratify.
What clauses in the Constitution made the Constitution a better document significantly than the Articles of Confederation?
The first three did a lot. Of the seven articles in the Constitution, the first three really, for the most part, undid the infrastructure of the articles by establishing, first of all, the Congress and the powers that the Congress would have. The second, by giving the president not only position but authority as a legislative versus an executive branch. That was roughly equivalent. And third, a judiciary that was federal as opposed to nine individual state judiciaries that had an entire gamut of operations and rules and everything else. That federal law would supersede.
See, the Constitution to me has to be a parchment which is supposed to guarantee my liberty and my freedoms. And the Articles of Confederation ran pretty well for about 7 years after the Revolution. All of a sudden, the Constitution came along, and then we had that. But we had eight presidents prior to Washington, or six presidents prior to Washington, and now we have the Constitution. And the Constitution, I'd like to know what made it significantly better than the Articles of Confederation, because I've read not all of the articles, but I've read the Articles of Confederation for the most part, and it seems to me that they were doing a good job. And now the Constitution's here, and the Constitution really hasn't done that much.
Well, I would certainly disagree with that, but I would tell you that the Constitution did for everyone what the articles did for each individual state. The individual states did not recognize, for instance, one another. And there were states that were trying to establish treaties with other states, and just a whole gamut of things as the states were trying to identify the relationship they had to each other and to this thing that was called or about to be called a nation. And they were a federation of independent sovereigns, which could have been fine, but the trouble was they weren't. They were making agreements that they weren't keeping. They were, you know, on the western border of our state you can do this, but on the eastern border of our state you have to do this instead. And it became relationship state between state that was conflicting inside the state itself, if that makes sense.
Was there a Supreme Court that was established by the Articles of Confederation?
No. If I remember correctly, there was a tribunal, but it had no power. It certainly had no enforcement power. It had no jurisdiction. It was there, but it wasn't really effective because it had no jurisdiction and no enforcement power. It had no ability to unify the law across the states. So you had state courts that were pretty much holding up that purpose, and they were as different as day was from night. And
They surely were working it out. The thing that bothers me is that if we had a government for 6 or 7 years and then the Constitution comes along, I'd still like to know what was significantly wrong with the prior government that allowed these people to come in and just take over. And the people who were already conforming to the Articles of Confederation couldn't have been very happy about it. Seems to me like the Constitution was a usurpation of authority.
No, I don't believe so. You got to remember that during the Revolutionary War, each colony had established its own constitution.
Mm-hmm.
They had generally a strong legislative body and a weak executive body, and the articles were approved in November of 1777, and then by 1781. The states had ratified it, and it was a weak government, but the idea was that it was to represent at least a national government, which in fact it did not do. It did not have an executive or a judicial branch of government, but it did have a Congress.
No, they had the presidents. They had six presidents. A president each year was elected to be the head of the country.
What I said was they didn't have an executive branch.
Mm-hmm.
They had an executive, but they didn't have an executive branch. They didn't have a judicial branch that covered all the states. Okay? We were still dealing with in-house romper room juveniles, each wanting their own way. And the executive was pretty much without power. And it was considered to be a league of friendship. That's what the articles call themselves, a league of friendship and fidelity between each of the several states. I don't know that that's significantly different than what would become real during the Constitution. But as I read your opinion, you seem to think that the Constitution is a usurpation of the power of the states. Is that right?
No, the powers are not. Well, yeah, in essence, yeah. The states should have their own individual sovereignty, and they should be part of a club, and they should give allegiance to the club. But the thing is, the states recognize that they are part of a country, still should have their own particular sovereignty, so that they can do, you know, to a degree, but not nowadays. And for all practical purposes, they have no sovereignty. They're too beholden to the government.
Well, I disagree with you on that, but I think that there's room for discussion about it because it almost comes, when you talk about state sovereignty, you then have to look at each individual state, I think. You know, how do we have states and commonwealths in a unified confederation of states that become the United States, because they're significantly different in points that really matter? And is the Western state that's got,
they had commercial problems. They had commerce, which they had to work out. The Supreme Court of the Constitution was supposedly devised in order to make sure that the problems that did happen between states would be decided by the Supreme Court. Now, nowadays, with regards to what you and I are disagreeing about in terms of sovereignty of the states, is that since the states are borrowing money to the hundreds of millions of dollars cumulatively over the years from the federal government has ties with those particular loans. And that means that the governors, they have to do, in essence, what the federal government wants them to do.
I think there's a reality in that, but I think you have to go back to, if you borrow money from me under an agreement, there is, if not a statutory, at least a moral obligation to honor the terms of that agreement. And if that represents a dependent relationship, in the final analysis, I would say so be it. But in reality, I don't think it necessarily does, because I think you have to have two independent or sovereign entities in order to make such an agreement that we will do this because you need this money for this purpose. We become a bank to that degree, which means that we have some holding interest in your reality, whether it be property,
your constitution, the laws that you make, and the agendas that you have, and that's what the federal government is doing.
Mm-hmm. But when you become a state, you agree that that will be the supreme law of the land. That's one of the things that territories had to agree to.
Well, I'm not talking about back then. I'm talking about now.
Oh, okay.
Now,
well,
states have given up their sovereignty.
I don't see that, but that's across a different perspective. And in the state where you live, for instance, where do you live?
Montana.
Okay.
Every state has given it up because every state is beholden to the federal government for the loans that they and the grants that they give to that particular state. The states don't get loans and grants just because they're nice. They get them because they're following the dictates of the federal government, which is why we're in the kind of mess we're in today.
Well, isn't that the same with any bank? If you go to a bank, we were talking about employers. If you go to a bank, you have to get a loan according to their rules, don't you?
The only rules that you have when you get a loan out from the bank is to pay back the interest on time. When you're getting a loan from the federal government, you have to give up certain agendas. You have to give up the decision-making process. You have to allow the government to intrude on your particular agenda.
But where does that stop because you're a state and begin because you're receiving money from the federal government?
Where does that stop?
Yeah. I mean, where's the dividing line between...
It doesn't. If you're going to borrow so much money that you have to pay it back in taxes by robbing your own citizens, and you don't want to do that because that could mean elections, then you're still beholden to the federal government. That's why we have a lot of 501(c)s. We have these lands which are being 28%, I think, of America is supposedly owned by the federal government. The federal government shouldn't own hardly any land whatsoever. And the states, they can't do what they really want to do because of famous and infamous backdoor deals.
Well, you've got a rich history in backdoor deals.
Mm-hmm.
And your state has a rich history.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not picking out yours, but yours
it's
is
okay.
a clear case
matter.
Evidence that you can see. But in order to be United States, certain things were decided to be applicable across the board. And as far as today goes, I'm not really of an opinion that has been completely undone, although I will grant you that on both sides of the consideration, there have been excesses taken. And I think that is part of why the Constitution still works. I think that is why we still continue to go forward, because it proves, to me at least, that the Constitution is a living document that is subject to amelioration when it's necessary. There are a lot of things that we can talk about as the federal government, in your term, is abusive. States can be pretty abusive, too.
Not towards the federal government, it can.
Sure they can. They can toward the federal government, and their citizens become the victims of it. Take, for instance, from my view, the expansion of Medicaid or Medicare. Okay? If a state decides that for whatever reason it's going to deprive its citizens of affordable health care insurance, knowing that it doesn't have the budget to create a replacement, and the net result is that 300,000 citizens that could be on a system of health care that would bring income to your state, it's like shooting yourself in the foot from what I see, but states say we have the ability to determine whether or not we are going to become involved at this level with a federal government. And there are 16 states who have said, we are not going to do that. The net result is their citizens suffer for it.
Naturally.
They don't.
In the short term, yeah. But in the long term, if the states actually rebelled against Obamacare and actually practiced actuarial
suicide
procedures, no. Insurance is not a right. Okay. Insurance
didn't say it was.
No, but insurance.
But I think you know what? I think the right of a people to have affordable health care is a right. I do. I think that's one of the definitions of what a civilized society is.
Have to be provided by the government the way that it's made up its economic policies. Can't be done the way that it's being done now. If it was done
it's
in
being
a different
done,
way.
I think, well, I would like to see it done a different way.
Well, you have to know government. You have to know government economics. When we have a currency which is debt-driven, you can't have any social programs that aren't in the long term going to bankrupt the nation.
What would you suggest?
You get rid of the Federal Reserve, and you bring the power back to the Treasury, and you limit government, and everything will be fine.
How do you limit government?
You have to get rid of the agencies that are taking up space in America by having too much power and being too corruptible by lobbyists.
Like
you limit like the EPA, FDA, FCC, and all the rest of the alphabet agencies, which are being ruined by any kind of administration, Republican or Democrats, that want to pay off their campaign donors, and as a result, the American citizens suffer. Take, for example, I'll give you my example. Years ago, okay. I had an insurance policy. It cost mm-hmm. only $13 a month.
Mm-hmm.
It was 80-20.
Okay.
So if I had $1 billion, $2 billion of hospital bills, the provider would pay 80% of it. I would pay 20% of it,
mm-hmm.
and I had my fair deductibles. And all of a sudden, it went up to $53 a month, from
mm-hmm.
1 month 13 to 53, as a result of HMOs coming in. Anytime you have the federal government stepping in, you're going to have a boondoggle. You won't get things done on by deadline, and you'll have overcosts. And you'll have to have those costs made up by taxing the American people. Then you have a hell of a lot of corruption. And we don't have checks and balances as people have been brainwashed and believing since first grade. So the smaller the government, the lesser the chances of corruption, which means that the American people, just like in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, would be able to take care of themselves and have a prosperous nation because of competition, not cronyism.
What about corporate cronyism?
It's the same thing. If you have corporate cronyism, that means that you have corporate leaders lying in bed with the government, which is fascism. That's what we have today.
I see. Well, it's an interesting point of view, Joe, and I thank you for calling. I've got to go because I've got a couple other guests that they're waiting to talk. But I appreciate your call, and I hope you'll call back again.
All right. Take it easy.
Give us something to think about, and I thank you for it.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye now. Okay. That's Joe from Montana. We now have, speaking of Oklahoma, we have a caller from Oklahoma named Jack. Jack, welcome to the show. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Okay. I disagree with the guy very much, but that's not the point. I have two suggestions I got to push.
Okay.
Number one, and maybe he has something to count. Okay. First of all, you're too beholden to the Republican and Democratic politicians alike. I think more so the Republicans than the Democrats are too beholden to the donors, big donors like Steyer and Soros on the Democrat liberal side, and Koch brothers, Karl Rove. Alec and what's his name?
You're looking for Grover Norquist?
Cronyism.
Okay.
What?
I thought maybe you were trying to find the name Grover Norquist.
Grover Norquist too. Yeah. He used to be one of the evil six. Evil Six, Grover Norquist is one of them. And,
mm-hmm.
Of course, and I got the Koch brothers. I call them dinosaurs. When they're my age, around my age in the 80s, they're tired old dinosaurs. They want to ruin the good five fascistic friends.
Mm-hmm.
And if God will go quick, just free, no financial contributions. Now, and campaign finance for all, and that's including the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court should be limited to maybe 10 or 15 years term. Arguing is that the judges take a long time to decide, and that's the two things I'm I'm pushing.
So you believe that we should publicly finance all elections?
Yes, you publicly finance all elections.
And you believe that Supreme Court justices should be elected? Or
Supreme Court should be, they can be appointed, but they have a, okay, the president is J. Edgar Hoover. Now, J. Edgar Hoover, that was the head of the FBI, the original head of the FBI, was appointed for life. Now, he got to be a dictator and had too much power. The old issue is power, and the old issue is money and politics. You eliminate money in politics, and you eliminate power in politics. Power is the necessary absolute evil. And that's what I'm going on, and that's what I believe there are some people who agree with me.
I believe there are a number of people who agree with you, Jack. The question is, should there be power in politics? Should politics have power? I mean, politics at the federal level determines what each of us does day to day, how we do it, even where we do it, when we do it. There's long been the reality in America that there's no particular moment of your existence that doesn't at least brush up against some sort of federal power or state power or local power.
Yeah. Well, okay. Now, talking about state power, now the previous guy was saying, all right, you take the social issues such as abortion. I don't believe in abortion. Take education, take a lot of education from the age of 3 to all kids in the And you know about we're on a Puritan philosophy that sex is bad. I think is to know about kids knowing about the opposite sex, their organs and all of that stuff is bad things, or they're playing around with all that stuff.
Okay.
I think that education is a cure-all for a lot of the ills that we are as a society would be. And pre-K would be a start. I have a great-grandson who is just turned 3. So three in November.
Uh-huh.
The other one I have is he's going to be a year old come the 25th of this month. I'm diametrically opposed to anything Paul Ryan suggests. He wants to expand the military, wants more money for the military, and the domestic programs kaput. Food stamps and the yeah.
Doesn't that kind of sing with what Joe was saying?
Yeah.
Except Joe was a little bit more strict than that, in that he was in favor of the Articles of Confederation.
Well, that's where I agree with Joe on certain things. I think if you eliminate all donors, big donors, big donor contribution out of the Supreme Court, and you you eliminate the terms of the Supreme Court to 10 or 15 years, and maybe there's some good Supreme Court justices. In my time, there weren't too many.
Yeah.
You go back 82 years, maybe Thurgood Marshall would have been one, and maybe Frankfurter, yeah, might have been a good one, yeah.
Yep.
And other than that, if you have, and maybe Cassandra Day O'Connor may have been a good justice.
Who's a good one today?
Three women today, yeah. That was going. Today there may be, questions about maybe five of the conservative justices. I would say especially.
You think it's okay to be able to identify a justice as being liberal or conservative?
Not. Not really. I mean, I'm trying to get away from labels.
Yeah. But, yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, Jack.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. Fine. Let's keep you on hold for a little bit and see if anybody will call in and have a discussion with you about that. I think you can raise some good points. Can we do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll put you on hold. We've got a call from area code 678. Somebody would like to talk to us about medical billing. Are you with us?
Hey, how you doing? This is Q from Atlanta.
Hello, Q from Atlanta. This is a Tennessee Progressive from Nashville.
Hey.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Now, I will give a disclaimer.
Okay.
I am conservative. I am conservative. I'm a black guy. But I believe in America first. So it doesn't have to agree with me because I don't agree with Republicans as much. Which is kind of weird. I believe in conservative thought processes, but I don't believe in this Republican clicking up that they do.
Is this relatively new for you, or is this something that's been kind of consistent in your political
life? Well, it's been consistent. I've been conservative since George I.
Okay.
That's the only conservative that I like, because I think he did things for the country, good or bad. I think a lot of other conservatives, I never liked Ronald Reagan. I think he actually did way worse than Jimmy ever did. So that just gives you a thought process. Conservative for me is all about nothing really radical, you know, nothing really out of the norm. We do things here and there for the sake of growth, but not these things for the sake of money.
Mm-hmm.
I know that that's a crazy thing, but that's my philosophy. But anyway, really quickly on billing, I work in billing. So what I try to share with people a lot of time is patients have an idea of what they think the Obamacare or the billing stuff is, but naturally really don't know. And one thing one of your callers made a statement with, which is very true, anytime government gets involved, it does get jacked up. There's no denying that. But the problem is something had to happen because, as I saw being a conservative for the past decade and a half, Republicans just basically did nothing, made no attempt to do anything. And you can't have that because what the problem with health care was all about was doctors getting sued and mom bringing her son in for a sniffle. Those things put such a drain on the industry that they had to negate people from getting coverage who had conditions and what have you. So in order for them to be operational and also help Humana put in their package out here in Atlanta, which they're the forefront for Obamacare, you got to understand that something had to happen. So that's why I'm not so much mad at Obamacare. And then when you look at the Supreme Court, if we had not voted for auto insurance back in the day, we'd not put the word mandate into law. And people don't understand, when you vote for one thing, you sometimes set up yourself on a back door for other things.
Of course.
Part of the discussion about Obamacare was mandate. Well, you allowed mandate into the law when you voted for auto insurance, and that was one of Scalia's little points. So I did want to say, as far as the medical billing piece, it had to happen. It doesn't really help people right now who who are regular basic people. It helps mostly people who never could get coverage. But I think in 2016, 2018, it'll start evening out, and it'll look a lot like Canada, where the caller was right. You'll get taxed for it, and it'll probably drop by another $100-$200 a month and kind of even out.
Well, I think that's a real possibility looking to the future of the Affordable Care Act. What many people really don't understand is the relationship between the healthcare industry, the health insurance industry, and the people who are the consumers. And one of the things that happens is when you're an insurance company and you get an additional 7 million insureds, that's a good thing. And it really doesn't matter what classification they go into. They can be a high-risk pool or a non-user. But it does overall, having been in the healthcare and the health insurance industries both in my life, I can tell you from experience, tends to level out on the high side.
Right.
That there are, it's just not the case that there are more people needing medical care in general, overall, on a daily basis. The truth is that, on average, most people don't need continuing health care. Because there's either, you know, by class or however you want to look at it, they're in better shape, they're younger, they have taken care of themselves, or they do take care of themselves, because this generation of youngsters is very much involved in self-care and preventative care and maintenance and all that. Our young generation is growing as a healthier society in many aspects, an unhealthier society in some aspects. But the idea that the healthcare industry can uniformly deny healthcare coverage to someone because it's Tuesday, and you know as well as I do that that happens, and Humana had a lot to do with that when their case managers were, you know, paid incentives to disapprove, to disenroll, to not for the purposes of healthcare, but for the purposes of profit through the HMOs.
Profit,
making doctors their income producers, then that became a problem. And that was something, even as they created the HMO, they knew it was a limited ride. But they were going to take what they could out of it, and they took quite a bit. Now, the ACA is beginning, I'd like in my most ideological thoughts to believe, to encourage healthcare providers and healthcare insurance providers to really rein themselves in a little bit and come to understand that there's really not a lot of reasonability to a $978 aspirin, or that you don't charge 42% higher because someone happens to be female, or that because you have had Well, one of the ones that I remember specifically was, you know, have you ever had scarlet fever? Yes. Sorry, we don't insure for that. So we don't exclude scarlet fever from your policy. We simply do not issue the policy. And then, as it became apparent to the healthcare industry and the health insurance industry that the ride was about to be curtailed, they involved themselves in a heinous practice that became known as underwriting at the time of claim.
Yeah.
They would issue anybody a policy. The policy had no merit. It was junk insurance, and it was cheap. But, you know, unless you got run over by a steamroller in the fast lane at 4 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, all you got was a Band-Aid. We will accept your next $100 premium. Thank you very much.
And that's why I said... And that's why I said there needed to be some adjustment, because, as you said eloquently, the end user frivolously didn't understand their insurance and what it's for.
And
some
the health care provider fully expected that to be the case. The insurance was written for that purpose.
So now when you got, even in Obamacare, some of these sticker prices that people don't like, I explain to people all day long, this is what coverage is. And a person will say to me, well, why isn't it like that outside of America? And I always use this analogy, which is not good practice to use, but I use it off the clock, not while I'm on the clock. I said that's because you're not going to be able to sue most of the doctors.
Or the hospital.
You go to it.
Mm-hmm.
you go to a doctor understanding that you're going to be helped as best as he can help you. Okay?
And that's not necessarily the truth, but yeah, that's the understanding.
Right, that's the blatant understanding. I mean,
like I said,
it's not, you already know healthcare is very detailed. You go into several paragraphs trying to explain one question, but in a nutshell, I always tell the people the horrific side of it because it can get that way. You can be in a horrific situation. And I just tell people, you're basically not going to sue the doctor unless he just left a scalpel inside of you or something crazy like that. But you're not going to be able to sue doctors because you didn't get the certain type of thing you thought you should get. Some of these countries don't even support that type. So that's why they're healthcare is low.
That's why you have issues. I mean, this extends. It becomes a virus that infects every American in ways they never expected it would. For instance, tort reform. We've now established that the value of a human life is capped at $250,000. Why?
Okay.
Because the American Medical Association got tired of paying malpractice fees. That's why.
Right.
Why is it that women who have been pregnant have higher rates than those who don't? Because 1 in 9 pregnancies result in death. That's why.
Right.
We don't understand that. We don't expect
that. And that's why I said the end user doesn't understand
that's
how it is as a norm. You just because you saw 1,000 people make it with no problem doesn't mean 1,002 is going to be that same way.
Isn't that the very principle of insurance?
Right, right.
I agree with you on that. I love insurance. I think insurance is Mr. Franklin's finest invention, you know?
I agree.
That we need to understand that life insurance isn't. It's death insurance.
No, I think
we need to understand that health insurance isn't. It's hospital insurance.
I think we need to understand
that auto insurance isn't. It's damage insurance.
I don't even know what auto insurance is. Can you explain that one?
Yeah, it's damage insurance. If you damage your car, if you hurt somebody in the process, then it becomes casualty insurance.
Well, you will agree with that same philosophy. There was no reason for us to mandate it.
I didn't see any option. Did you?
I mean, because coverage is between you and your vehicle and what you do and do not do. It doesn't pertain to the next person, just like health insurance doesn't pertain to the next patient.
How do we deal with that? We created an uninsurance pool. We created a non-insurance class. Uninsured motorist insurance.
The only reason I even brought it up is because I've seen, and again, this goes to my I'm America first, I've seen by us do that just on that side topic, that we create all of these micro counties and micro cities whose traffic cases have went up through the roof and whose revenue has skyrocketed because you got officers now instead of stopping a thief, he's driving around looking at plates.
It's a transmutation of responsibilities and obligations and expectations. And if you know, we don't have auto insurance, the first thing that I say is, what is the most expensive object you will ever buy in your life? For 99% of Americans, it's a home.
Right.
So we have homeowners insurance that if this asset becomes damaged or uninhabitable, you will get some help in finding another one. You pay for that. If you have a home, what is the next expensive thing that you will purchase in your life? It's a car.
Right, that would be your vehicle.
So we have insurance for that in case something happens to it that makes it non-functioning. You can get some help in getting a functioning automobile, unless somebody, by their negligence, incapacitates your vehicle and or you while in it. And then we have damages that come into play, many of which involve hospitals. You know, people get killed every day in America on highways. The amazing thing is that most people who are involved in auto vehicle accidents don't die. They almost die.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's true.
And then you have long-term disability, you have short-term disability, and all of a sudden the insurance comes up and says, hey, we can create a product for that, but you'll pay for it. And it grew to the point where all of a sudden it wasn't a little from everybody just in case. It was a lot from everybody because, by God, we're going to be a business about this and we're going to make some money.
Absolutely. And well, you know, before I leave, I have a question to ask you because I got to do another show. But a quick question to ask you. So how do you feel about this whole the equal pay thing that just came up?
I want Florida to ratify the ERA. I want two more states to ratify the ERA. I want everybody to have a fair shot. I believe that if you are a woman and I am a man, that we do the same job, that we should not be given a lesser pay simply or a greater pay simply because of our sex. I believe that there's no such thing as I don't necessarily believe that men are naturally smarter or more capable than women. Because I've known too many brilliant women that made me look like a slob. And I believe that if I am going to do the work and you're going to do the work, we should receive at least equal consideration for the work that we do. So I'm in favor of the Equal Pay Act.
Okay. The only reason I'm against it is because the way they equate it had to do with bonuses and things of that regard. And the only way you can gather that information is under the assumption that you have gathered that information from your male counterpart. My other issue, working in healthcare, like you've been exposed to healthcare, ladies do not hire males, even qualified males, at the rate that they hire ladies. Even with
I'd
my
love
personal
to see a study supporting that.
Well, I've had actual directors that I've spoken with. So here's the thing.
Okay.
Just like you would like to see a study on that, I haven't seen a study that is specific that it had to be gender. I've seen cases where a person went and asked the other gender and the gender revealed what their pay was and that was the situation. So here's the issue. And I'm not trying to get off your topic, but here's the issue that I have with it, is that if what I'm saying is true, that ladies are very prejudiced toward hiring males, which is, the director over the EEOC in Baltimore, 60% of her EEOC claims are male. Here in Atlanta, 55% are male of all the claims filed for hiring issues.
Okay.
If what I'm saying is true, then what do we put in a tag along to the bill to guarantee that ladies allow males in those departments and in those to where it's not just a reverse of the Equal Pay Act, and do we strengthen the EEOC more? Do we say that, well, hey, the same time off that the lady is allowed, the man should have time off, or do we just say, we're men, we deal with it, let's give the ladies an edge?
I think that what the Equal Pay Act does, and one important foundational point to your question, is it expects, anticipates, encourages, supports, and endorses equality across the board. We begin with pay because it is readily apparent from data across the United States, across decades, that women on average receive 77 cents on every dollar. Actually, it's gone down 74 cents now for every dollar man earned in exactly duplicate profiles. Okay? Age, job requirements, job performance, job responsibilities, job perks,
The only difference is gender. And the major issue difference is gender. You then start to look at the glass ceiling. How high can anyone in a given job say we're working for Humana? And you start out together on the same day in the same job. Is it your specific capability that gets you the promotion? Should it be? Should there be some kind of special recommendation or recognition because of your race or your religion or your nationality or your sexual orientation or your gender? What we've said across the board is, generally, no. It should be your capability. If a woman is more capable, that woman that started with you as a CSR at Humana 12 years ago has been promoted, and it is because of her capability, do you think that you would have a problem with that, yes or no?
No, because I'm always going to be told it's because of her capability. I mean, even in my personal journey, just to answer your question more directly, I have 5 certifications. I've known gentlemen that have had certification in their field, and they've got passed up by people that had no certification at all because they were ladies, and you get told they were just more qualified. So that's just something you swallow on a general. So, yes.
Right, but I'm talking about you and your friend in the next cube, okay? If you see your friend promoted, the reason for the promotion is because of their capability, and you agree with that. Does it matter with you whether they're woman or man, black or white?
Not at all. Not at all. Not at all.
Do you think it matters to most people?
I think it matters to most women. And I'm not woman-hating. Okay. I got 5 sisters that I love. I think it really matters to most ladies because...
Each of whom is going to beat you senseless when you get off the radio. Yeah.
No, they're not. But my point is one of fairness. It's just that... You know, and I don't want to get into the rebuttal of it, but my only point is just fairness. I would hate to see our sons, once ladies get empowered in such a way. EEOC just this past 2 weeks, 6 female companies that they took to court for their hiring practices against men.
Discriminatory hiring practices, right.
Right. So this is 6 in 2 weeks. This isn't like they're going on a binge looking for them. They're just blatantly doing it. So my thing is, it is my hope that gentlemen who are really for this fairness, and I have no problem with it as a whole, I really don't, when our sons are the ones who continue to take up more and more on the EEOC, and these women groups continue to block fairness issues for males, whether it be father's rights, whether it be male employment rights, I want to see guys who were for this issue come back out and say, well, ladies, hold on. We were for you. Why are you doing that? That's all I hope. But I hope
I hope so, too. I hope so, too. Thank you for your call
today.
I appreciate it. Please call us back again. We look forward to
it.
Bye-bye.
You have a beautiful day.
Okay, you too. Okay. So we talked about some of the important things going on. And we have room for your call at 646-929-2495. This is Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, and I am the Tennessee Progressive. We'll be here for 10 more minutes. I want you to be aware of situations that are going on around the country. This is the Sunday before Tax Day, and we have equality of taxes. We have the justification of the Articles of Confederation. We have the idea that women's equality is not necessarily going to guarantee women's equality. We have the issue of fairness in all of these things, actually. When is money fair? And if money has no fairness in it, that he who has the most money, you know, the golden rule, he who has the gold makes the rules, then how do we explain to the Koch brothers that they can't buy democracy? How do we explain to the Koch brothers and the ultra-conservative right-wing PACs that they really don't need to be fomenting insurrection against the United States via a farmer in Nevada? that a guy who has been a corporate welfare recipient from the United States government and the Bureau of Land Management since 1983 now tells the Bureau of Land Management what to do with their weapons on their land. I don't believe there's a lot of fairness in that. I believe that the Koch brothers and who are, by the way, directly into this particular issue in Nevada, the AFP in two states, Nevada and Colorado, have funded militias to travel to Nevada for the purpose of showing up with their weapons and lining up in military formations on the interstate. This is not over. This is a guy who is a very bad individual. He has been involved in corporate welfare to the millions of dollars, and he owes the United States government a ton of money. And the federal government said, well, we'll start taking your property. He said, no, you won't. I'm a sovereign citizen. That's not over yet. I can tell you that's not over. Okay? In a matter of public safety, on the government side, they say it's a matter of public safety. We don't want to get anybody unnecessarily wounded or engaged. And on the other side, they say we won this massive victory against the socialist communist government of the United States. No, you didn't. What you've done is through people you don't even know with agendas you can't possibly begin to understand, they're using you as a tool. And they're using their money to do it. And if you believe anything else, you need to check your facts. And there's plenty of facts available. If an individual can determine what rules he's going to live by and avoid those rules with which he disagrees, not only within his state or his county, but also his country, then we have a problem. Because one of the things that America is based upon is the rule of law. And that means the respect of the law. The question is, can that respect be broken by money? And there are many in this country, myself included, who believe that people seem to believe the answer to that question is yes. That democracy can be not overthrown, but undone through the inexorable pressure of economics. This is not a new story. To my friend Joe in Montana, let's not forget the robber baron days. Let's not forget that equality was written out of Minnesota's Constitution and then put back in and then taken back out. Let's not forget that there are people who really want this country to fail inside this country because they don't like what this country stands for. Let's not forget that this country was established and ordained by we, the people. And that most of us have agreed to continue that relationship, perhaps not necessarily voluntarily, because some of us were born here, and we became heirs and assigns of that legacy at the moment of our birth. It wasn't all good. It's not all good now, but the agreement has always been that we, the people, have the ability to make the changes that we seek. It doesn't mean that we have the right to become anarchically autonomous. We do not support as a nation that concept. We do not support as a nation the idea that eight men can control everything within this country. We just don't see it that way. We don't believe that a privately funded PAC can create legislation that the rest of the country must necessarily therefore live by. That's not the way our democracy works. When you register and qualify to vote, your vote means something. It's not something you can just casually lay aside without damaging that which you receive benefit from. There's no damage unless you don't vote. And when you don't vote, regardless of your position of a political ideology, a policy, or a program, what you're doing is you're saying to democracy, no, no thanks. That's the way I see it. You cannot influence change by not voting. Okay? That's like trying to convince a wall that gravity should work. And if you have untold sums of money that you have received as a benefit of your citizenship in this country, it does not make sense that being the recipient of the grace and gratitude of this country, you then use the benefits that you've received to destroy it. Simply because you can. There is a limit to individual sovereignty as citizenship goes. It's not possible for an individual to usurp the federal government. It's not possible. That's the agreement we made a long time ago. That's where anarchy comes from in the most negative sense. That's why we decided not to agree to be represented and controlled by a monarch. That's why we said that we, the people, do hereby establish and ordain this Constitution. It was an agreement made amongst the people, a completely democratic voted reality. And to say, you know, that we should never have left one situation on behalf of another one is every citizen's right. They don't have a right to hold the federal government as hostage. And the federal government does not have the right to hold its citizens as hostage simply for policy or program considerations. You as citizen have the power and the right to let your voice be heard. So let your voice be heard. Not at the point of a gun. Okay, if you believe that you have the right to steal from the United States government, even after having been caught, even after failing to prove your case many times up to a federal appellate court, there's a point at which you have to submit to the reality that you live in a democratic society. It's not all about you. And the millions that you have made, not only at the behest of, but in spite of Americans, is going to come back on you. And don't believe that this situation in Nevada is by any means over. You have something that you can do about it. I encourage you this tax weekend to do something positive about it. Become the change you seek. But if you believe that becoming the change you seek is only going to happen at the point of a gun, you've already lost. Because nobody in this country is going to agree to that. Coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the mighty Duck River, for the past 2 hours, I have been the Tennessee Progressive. The show will replay this coming Tuesday evening, beginning at midnight Eastern Time on Netroots Radio at netrootsradio.com for the coffee party for Netroots Radio and for the Progressive Politics Tennessee Style radio show. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye for now.